Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast. We're back. So guys, it's a new term. Conference season is off to a hectic start. Excited, rituals. I've got a new notebook. I always start this time of year with a new notebook.
Even if the other one's not full up yet?
Even if, so this is it. I'm showing the notebook. It's a burgundy Leuchtturm. It's got kind of weird pages. What I like about this notebook is it's got two ribbons. So one for marking your place, and then if you want to build an index or something like that, it's quite fancy. And I've started the new conference season with this. We were chatting about it before we started recording, weren't we, Caroline, about how strange it is again. I suppose we experienced this in the spring, but autumn. These kind of strange extended virtual conferences.
Yeah, it's weird, like, because usually September coincides with a lot of anxiety dreams I get around missing planes and losing passports. And so that's usually how I know, oh, conference season is upon us. I'm having, like, I'm going to miss a flight somewhere and get in trouble with someone's PR team somewhere. And yeah, I haven't had any of those. But yeah, it's weird this year that a lot of the conferences that used to be, say, like maybe 5 days long are now being stretched out over sort of the course of several weeks, which kind of makes sense, I guess, because obviously there's a lot of content to get through and a lot of these conferences are having to be done across various time zones. So they're trying to make them as accessible as possible to everybody. But yeah, it's when you see it in your diary, it's like, oh, there's like this vendor's conference in the last 5 weeks. You're just like, oh my God, I just want my life back. I can't be doing that. But it's fine. It's just, like I say, it's a change in mindset. Just got to roll with it and just try and work our way through it, really. But without any of the anxiety dreams to take up space in my head, hopefully I've got the mental capacity to get through this conference season, however weird and wonderful it turns out to be.
I don't get with remote working how anybody has any business doing a conference in the evening. Like, no. But that, I suppose spreading it out over a longer time means that you don't have to occupy people's evenings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is true, because so much of going to conferences is about the networking in the evenings and things like that. I always think conferences do kind of concentrate the mind. So if I'm at Oracle Open World for a week in San Francisco, I'm just thinking about Oracle. I'm not really thinking about anything else. But it's very different now. And also, I don't know if you've both experienced this, but conferences keep being sprung upon me. It's almost like a casualization of conferences. You get an email in the morning saying, oh, we've got our execs are doing a Q&A at 6 o'clock this evening. Do you want to join? Like, I had no idea your conference was on.
Yeah, no prep time.
Getting in the zone time. You know, because if you wake up in a hotel somewhere in Amsterdam or San Francisco, you kind of know you're there for a reason. That's very obvious.
Yeah, I always find that conferences are like, you are completely removed from your normal situation. So it does give you time to reset your brain and mindset and get all of the stuff that you have to do in order. Even the stuff that isn't to do with the conference, I always sort of, it gives you a better ability to prioritize stuff because you can't do the stuff that isn't important because you're not there. You're not even on the same time zone that you would normally be. So you sort of, when you're removed from your normal situation, or when I am anyway, I always find that like my ability to prioritize gets better.
Yeah, and I've experienced a similar thing. And I think on the podcast we've spoken before about how everyone in the UK is shutting down for the evening. I mean, if you're on the West Coast, then and that can be quite nice in a way.
Yeah, there's no distractions. Like you say, you can usually plan in that there's going to be a drop off in the number of email, office related emails you're going to get sort of during the day. So you can just focus on the conference itself and being in that kind of conference bubble, which I always describe as being like feeling like you're cramming for an exam you're never going to take about, like, say, whoever's company is. Like, you find out so much additional context by sitting through, you know, some very, very long keynote sometimes, but also customer presentations and stuff like that. That, yeah, you do come, like, you land back at Heathrow after, like, oh my God, I know so much about, you know, I don't know, Google or Amazon, ask me anything. Everyone's like, no, no thanks. Yeah, it's a very strange experience going to a conference. And yeah, not having it this year is a bit like, oh, I've got so much extra free time, because you lose so much time. Because like, if you fly out on a Monday and then you fly back at the end of the week, you lose that weekend to jet lag, don't you? Or vice versa, if you fly out the weekend ahead of it, you lose that to traveling. And but yeah, as Claire said, you get to steal back a little bit of time. I find, as boring as this is, as much as I love kicking back on a plane, catching up on loads of films I've not seen before, I do get, there's just no distractions. So it's quite easy to do like that transcription you've been putting off for ages, or write up that case study you just haven't had a chance to get round to in the office. So quite useful, the things like that, just catching up on stuff as well. But I go back to the point Brian made about these conferences sneaking up on you. I think it's just because like, we're not being flown out there. So if you see, like, you get fair warning at least 6 weeks in advance, like, oh, we want to fly you here, we're going to book your flight. So you have mentally like, oh, okay, I know that that conference is going on this week, that week. Whereas now it's just like, I've got nothing to sort of give me a marker as to when any of this stuff's happening. It does feel very much like it's just come out of nowhere. Or maybe we all need to be keeping on top of the tech industry's diary and calendar a bit more better than we do. Because we're just like, oh my God, I didn't know this was going on. But
and like that thing you were saying, Caroline, about cramming for an exam, I sometimes think it's a bit like learning a foreign language, because you're immersed in AWS or Oracle or Salesforce for a week, in the same way that you can really only improve your language if you go and spend some time where the language is spoken. It's that total immersion thing.
I do feel sorry for our subs though, because after a week of being like immersed in all these American kind of, you know, keynotes that have all been tweaked within an inch of their life by marketing people, and you just end up, and you can't help it, you just end up subconsciously just chucking in phrases, and then you always get like a Skype message maybe 8 hours or so later saying like, oh, I just wanted to query this, what does spin up mean? You're like, oh yes. Yeah, it just means they've switched something on, like they've deployed something, sorry. Like, you just end up absorbing these phrases and you hate yourself for it a little bit, or at least I always do.
And of course you're jet lagged when you're writing, and quite often if I'm in San Francisco, say, or Vegas, I'll be writing in the middle of the night. So I wake up around 3 o'clock and I'm awake. So I just do a bit of writing.
Yeah, all of that time, the plane there and the time that you wake up in the middle of the morning because of jet lag always feels like, oh yeah, I've gotten extra hours. I've been gifted with more time. But actually what's happened is you're not sleeping. And you forget that. You sort of think like, yeah, I've got so much extra time, I'm just going to get loads of stuff done. It's like an endurance test, really.
Yeah. And I find that time actually really productive until it hits like 2 p.m. US time, and then I'm just dead. And then anyone who tries to talk to me, I'm just like, don't. There's just nothing. Like, I'm not here anymore. My brain has gone to sleep.
Yeah. No, I know. I've seen colleagues say that too.
There's just not enough conference coffee in the world to get you through that.
Although you do then tend to come to life a little bit more in the evening, I think, because you're on that cycle.
Sometimes jet lag moves in waves.
Yeah, I don't. I tend to just have to nap. That's me. Or like I say, I'm just gonna go to my room for a nap, and I might see you at the evening tonight, and then they'll never see me again. Like, I will never return, and then they'll see me the next day, and I'm always like, I feel great. I've had a good night's sleep now. Like, bring on the next day of the conference. But yeah, that first day, it's just like, we get through, we power through, and we just, you know, we're just thankful for whatever we can get done.
Just to signpost where we're heading in this episode, top line stuff. So speaking of events, Claire, you're very much in the midst of our own events.
Yes, so the organising of the diversity and tech event that we do every year in partnership with Sphinx. It's on the 1st of October, and it's my life at the moment.
Cool, and Caroline, you're going underwater.
Yes, yeah, I'm just going to lightly touch on some of Microsoft's experiments with dunking data centres into the sea, basically.
Sounds fascinating. I'll be continuing on a location theme. I'm going to talk about location data and digital maps. And I'll talk about that towards the end of the podcast. We're going to start today with Claire. Claire, you've been busily workshopping in the lead up to a conference.
Usually when we run the diversity event in person, we'll have workshops on the day. which are sort of around the same theme of the event, but with takeaways that people are meant to be able to go back to their life or their company and then be able to implement. We haven't got time on the actual day to run those as well because of the virtual nature of this year's event. So what we've done is do a workshop each week in the run-up to the main event on the 1st of October. So the one this week was about the gender pay gap, and that's the one that I'm going to talk to you about. And then next week I'll fill you in on some of the other ones that we've had. Cool. But basically the gender pay gap one, it was by TLA Women in Tech. And it was basically focused on the gender pay gap, but with the lens of COVID and the coronavirus outbreak, and then how that's affecting people like working mothers or people who are carers or single people. Because obviously there's been an increase in redundancies and furloughs and uncertainty and stuff like that. So the chair was Suki Fuller, who is standing in as the chair of TLA Women in Tech while the founder is on maternity leave. That's Sarah Luxford is the founder. And she started, which I thought was really cool. She started by saying, you know, we're all on a call about diversity in tech and about the gender pay gap and about being working parents. So it's okay if children run in and out of the frame while we're chatting or if there's noise, because considering that everybody's working from home at the moment, she was like, people are so apologetic about life happening, even though we're sort of having to mash work and life together, which I thought was a really cool way to start, to just sort of be like, it's okay. We all know that we're working and we're human and stuff happens.
Did it make you want to just like, God, if I could just get some children from somewhere or like an errant pet dog just to like, just cause some chaos right now.
Just be like, woo.
Get involved. Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing I have to distract me is myself. So I'm just going to run in out of frame. So to recap you on the gender pay gap.
Yeah.
From 2017, UK firms with over 250 employees were required to publish figures on the gender pay gap. So the gender pay gap is the average pay of all men and all women in an organization, regardless of role, because it's sometimes confused with pay equality, which is whether people are being paid to do the same role. So like if a man and a woman have the same role, but they're paid differently, that's equal pay. But the gender pay gap is an average of all people of all roles, like what men and women are paid.
Right.
Which then, if you have a pay gap, it's usually because, you know, you take into account all different roles across the organization, and higher up roles tend not to have women in them, if that makes sense. And so they'll be paid more because they're higher up, but there are fewer women in those roles.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
No. Okay, cool. So in 2016, I wrote a piece about recruitment firm Hired, who found that there's around a 9% gender pay gap in UK tech sector, which is also handy to note for the context of what we're going to talk about. But this year, because of the coronavirus outbreak, the government has said that firms don't have to do gender pay reporting this year, which was the start theme of the workshop, because it was a discussion about is that good enough, which as you can imagine, a lot of people said no it is not. And Sarah Luxford, who as I mentioned is on maternity leave at the moment but is the founder of Tech London Advocates Women in Tech Group, who were running the workshop, used the word riled. She said she was riled by this decision, especially since the initiative sort of only just started, and there's likely to be more turmoil and uncertainty in this current climate. So it would actually make more sense to carry on with reporting gender pay gap, or maybe even reporting, you know, how many people have been made redundant and what gender they are, to see if there's sort of a disparity. And basically the consensus was that the coronavirus outbreak shouldn't be used as an excuse not to do, you know, like the right thing, basically.
Like, it's an interesting point. There was an article this week, I can't remember where it was, but I'll make sure I dig out a link and we'll include it in the summary article, but just saying that women are being disproportionately affected economically by the coronavirus outbreak in terms of job security. A lot of jobs in female dominated industries have been sort of affected and people losing work there. So yeah, so it does seem when this is going on, it's almost like no one's tracking, or people are looking to sort of, oh, maybe we don't track so closely the impact it is having on women anymore. It just seems like the wrong thing to be doing. You need to be zeroing in on this a lot more closely, I think.
Yeah, exactly. If you think about the, like you said, the types of sector that women tend to be in a greater quantity in, they're also ones that might be disproportionately affected by rules around lockdown and stuff like that, I guess, as well.
Yeah.
But one of the things that Sarah was saying is part of a diversity and inclusion strategy is going to be making sure that there's equal pay and no gender pay gap. So if you have a strategy for improving your diversity and inclusion, why would you then suddenly be like, oh, we don't have to report this year because of COVID? Like, that shouldn't be something that you should just drop because things have gotten a bit tougher. It shouldn't be optional. It should be something that you're planning to do anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's sort of been being bandied about as a bit of an excuse. And then there was sort of a chat about working mothers and fathers, and this sort of, apparently mums are more likely to lose their jobs than fathers in this current climate. And there were some stats that Suki pulled up from Pregnant and Screwed that said that around 15% of women have been or expect to be made redundant at the minute. And of those people, 45% said that a lack of childcare factored into that decision. Because I suppose, because if you're working, and well, when kids were not at school, you're sort of trying to teach as well. Another panelist on the workshop, Toby Oradian, I think her name was, Oradian. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it, but she's the founder of a company called Black Ballad, and she's a journalist. And she said that working mothers are also more likely to be disrupted than working fathers when you've got kids at home, because you know, like, kids sort of, because of the way that society's been developed, sort of gravitate towards the mum as sort of like, mum, I need help with this, can you do this, can you help me? So like, it was sort of called into question whether working from home and flexibility is actually better for mums, because you know, everybody's always like, oh, you've got to give women flexibility to work from home if they want to for like childcare purposes and stuff. But like, are they any better off? Because if they're not getting work done during the day because their kids are interrupting them, they might end up having that always on culture of having to make up for the work at the end of the day, and then having a sort of like a poor mental health impact on that was one of the points made.
It really is something to keep an eye on, isn't it? I mean, the kind of complexity of gender disadvantage and stuff. I think I may have sent it to you, Claire. It was a Guardian thing about how the kind of blended working model and the kind of, at least the early stages of that, will probably disadvantage women, because like the guys are going back to the office and taking decisions and whatnot, whereas, you know, women maybe not getting childcare or whatever, are continuing to work from home, but not, you know, as much as men now are.
Yeah, and that's without taking into account other factors as well, like ethnicity or religion or location or socioeconomic background. And so that's just taking into account, you know, like gender differences, not even other disadvantages, but other situations that can leave you being even more disadvantaged by the way that work and society is set out. So it's a bit of a mess, isn't it?
Well, if one of the impacts of coronavirus is to make a lot of those progress that was made, you know, put it into question or retard it or whatever, I mean, that's something that seems to me to be underreported.
What you mean, whether it's made it better or worse?
Yeah, that aspect of making it worse, kind of unintended consequences, the kind of social impact of it.
Well, yeah, and I mean, if you're suspending gender pay reporting this year as well, like, actually that data could have been really useful.
Exactly.
In this context. So it's disappointing.
Well, thanks for that, Claire. I mean, it's brilliant, the work that we're doing, that you're doing, you know, in the whole area. And we've got the big event coming up on the 1st.
Mm-hmm. 1st of October.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I've got a very lame alliterative link to make. Quite often in this podcast, we go from diversity to data centres, and here we are again, under the sea.
Under the sea. It makes me want to break out into that Little Mermaid song. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say, but how much of it are we allowed to sing before we have to pay royalties?
Yeah, let's not go there. We are royalty-free, proudly, on this podcast. Yeah. So, it's a very, very exciting week in the life of this data centre journalist. As everybody knows, I bloody love a good data centre in all shapes and guises. The guys, most data centres is very, very similar. Invariably, they are kind of aircraft hangar-like places, kitted out with rack after rack of servers. And as someone who's done a lot of data centre tours in their time as a tech journalist, it can be very difficult after a while to distinguish one data centre from another. So the ones that tend to stick in mind are the ones that are in amazing locations, like the data centre in the cathedral in Barcelona we spoke about on the very first ever Computer Weekly Downtime Upload podcast, which I was very lucky and fortunate to visit. Another favourite of mine, which I have sadly never been invited to, hint hint, is the Lefdal Mining Data Centre in Norway. I've probably never been invited there because I don't know how to pronounce it, but that one is basically located under a mountain. And just the very idea of it is so Bond villain-esque. It's like, it's on my bucket list of top 10 data centres.
Oh, you
centers.
Must go. You must go.
So my bucket list of top 10 data centres I have to visit either before I die or before I quit being a tech journalist, whichever comes soonest. So that's on there. On that theme though, this week I got to revisit a data centre project in my reporting that I've really enjoyed covering over the last few years, which is Microsoft's rather novel Project Natick underwater data centre trials. So the origins of this actually predate my time at Computer Weekly, going back all the way to 2014, when Microsoft set out to test the feasibility of building subsea data centres as part of quite a wide-ranging sort of body of work. And most of it is sort of centred on trying to find ways, for Microsoft to try and find ways to meet its increasing need for cloud data centre capacity, but in ways that, you know, won't have an adverse effects on the environment. So as an example, you know, given how much energy data center operators consume to ensure the servers inside their facilities are kept cool, you know, the idea from Microsoft is that if you sink a sealed up data center full of hundreds of servers into the sea, that might provide a more cost-effective way of keeping it cool rather than having to invest in sort of mechanical systems and stuff like that.
If it's under the sea, how do you make sure that you can access it? Is there like cabling that runs down into the... I mean, it's cloud. Does the Wi-Fi get down? How does it work?
Yeah, network connected, the data centers, but they are designed so that the human interaction and tampering with them it should not be needed. So the plan is with this project that they would put servers inside these data centers that should be able to be left alone for about 5 years, which is the average lifespan of a data center server. So they could just leave them down there and just hopefully they will survive down there, they'll keep working and stuff like that. But it, like, one of the ideas is that you'll plunge a data center into the sea so that it'd be really close to the sort of subsea cables that send internet traffic all around the world and stuff like that. So that's one of the plus points for it. I'm not sure if they've done that on this occasion. I think these are just test vessels, so they haven't been completely hooked up. But that is one of the ideas, that by sending them out to sea, goodbye data centers, you hook them up to these subsea cables and that'll help with latency and things like that.
But have they thought about the possibility of spyfish?
I haven't seen that in any of the Microsoft blog posts on this, but I will raise the question to their PR team. Spyfish, very important consideration, guys. So one of the considerations on all this is, as I say, latency. If you can put them in the sea, if you put these facilities close to where the networking points are, that will improve latency. By, let's say, dunking them in water, which is already quite cool, will that help keep the server servers inside at the optimum temperature for working as well. But also another factor in all this, which is something I've been reporting on quite a lot over the last couple of years in Bees Weekly, is that basically the co-location hubs of the world, the major ones, are getting just increasingly full. So there is less spare capacity for sort of data centers, really, or less space to build data centers. So one of these ideas is that by putting them in the sea, we can sort of free up a bit more space. And there, you know, given how many cities in the world are, you know, close to the sea, it could benefit them as well. So it's, like I say, it's quite a nice story. You can kind of see how it all come together, what the plus points of all this will be as well. In Microsoft's case, they first tested this hypothesis by dunking a data center 1 kilometer off the Pacific coast in America for around 3 months in 2015. And that phase of the project was just focusing mainly on like how feasible any of this is. Like, should we really be, you know, putting data center servers, sealing them up and just throwing them in the ocean? Should we do that? So that was 3 months, and that was so successful, they decided to follow it up in 2016 by dropping a slightly bigger vessel with 864 servers in it off the coast of the Orkney Islands. And it's been sat there for the past 2 years processing data while all these data center boffins at Microsoft have been monitoring the performance of the servers, making sure, you know, it's doing everything it should be doing. So that one was more of a kind of long range project, which they also said was just having a bit more of a look at the economics of manufacturing sort of full scale undersea data centers and leaving them there for quite a long time. So the so that Orkney data center was called the Northern Isles, and they it has been reclaimed from the sea now. That's what Microsoft announced this week. You know, they've hoiked it out of the ocean, and they've had a number of interesting findings emerge as a result of it coming out and then having a look at what's happened to it. Probably the most notable thing, or one of the most notable things the company discovered, is that data center servers run in that environment, underwater, sealed in with dry nitrogen, just surrounding it, so quite a benign sort of atmosphere. They actually are more reliable than the does that run in Microsoft's equivalent facilities on land. So they've said that's going to provide them some useful lessons on what they can do to, not just in terms of building future underwater data centers, but what they could be doing to make sure their land-based ones are more reliable as well.
I would totally watch a film about this.
I know, it's so interesting. But also it's like a lot of the, like I say, they've done loads of blog posts on it, but just like the pictures of them like dragging, you know, these huge, yeah, like sort of bullet-shaped data centers out of the sea, covered in algae and barnacles and, yeah, whatever else. It's quite cool.
Yeah, like the Titanic, like the film, the James Cameron film, when they bring the safe up or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know for definite, but I'm not sure, like, the Microsoft PR team would like to be drawing parallels with, like, shipping disaster and their data center project.
Yeah. Very successful data center test that had nothing to do with the Titanic.
it's a descriptive comparison, we'll just say. It was not a... one is not like the other. That's just,
yeah, a possible cinematic comparison if they were to make a film about it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, the most scientific reason they've given as to why the underwater servers are just more reliable than the ones that they have on land is because of this fact we mentioned before, that the underwater data center, the Northern Isles data center, has been pumped full of dry nitrogen, which is a lot less corrosive than oxygen. So the servers just haven't come to as much peril, they haven't, you know, corroded, haven't had anything like that happen to them. But another reason they put forward as to why servers underwater are sort of more reliable than the on land ones, this sort of harks back to something Claire raised earlier around the human side of things, and that is simply because these data centers are sealed up and there's no humans in there, there is literally no one around to like walk into the servers and like sort of knock them over, or like, as Microsoft politely terms it, you know, there's no bumps and jostles of the equipment occurring because there's no people in there. So you just kind of think, put them undersea, keep them away from the humans, everything's more reliable. So I thought that was like, okay, that's probably the take-home message here. We need to just learn about data centers. The fewer people you have inside them knocking about equipment, just the better it is all round for how well they run.
Don't want people breathing on them either.
Well, no, it's probably not advised. Probably,
yeah,
not.
You know how, like, the pyramids are decaying because all of the visitors are breathing on them?
Mm. obviously there's, in any data center, there's obviously efforts made that people are advised to sort of, people are advised to sort of curb their clumsiness around servers and stuff like that. But they actually said a lot of the bumps and jostles, as they said, are quite well-intentioned. It's usually when people go in there to repair something else and then they end up bumping and jostling and knocking another server over or knocking into one server, which I quite enjoyed, just the visual image of that.
Yeah, and I think you find as well that people who are clumsy, it's not through a lack of trying not to be.
No.
You know, you can tell someone to be careful, but clumsiness just happens. Doesn't mean that people aren't being careful.
As a very clumsy person myself, also it puts pressure on you, like a self-consciousness that I can't be clumsy, and it almost makes you more 10 times more clumsy. So if we learn nothing else from this project, side note, if you do know a clumsy person, don't tell them they're clumsy, because they will be 10 times more so. That's my little learning from all this, Microsoft. That's basically it for the time being on the topic. I mean, there's, like I say, they've got this data center out of the sea now. They said there's a lot more research to come off the back of this project. And hopefully there'll be more to say just as it informs sort of the design of their future on-land data centers. But also if we do see more of these underwater data centers rolling off the production line at Microsoft in the years to come. Like I say, it's a really interesting project. There are, when we first wrote about it in 2016, there was a few things raised which were quite important points as well, which I haven't really seen much in the way of follow-up from Microsoft on.
It's just the thermal pollution thing.
Yeah, which I think is a good point. Just that you're having, even if it just causes a few degrees change in the sort of surrounding water temperature, what impact would that have on ecosystems, or would it just be barely perceptible anyway? That's something important to note. But there was also at the time people raising things around kind of data protection, like if the data centers are in the sea, whose jurisdiction are they under? What data protection laws would they have to abide by, or would it be completely lawless? You know, who owns the seats? So it's lots of stuff like that to work out. But no, like I say, it's just a really interesting project.
It's really interesting. It is interesting. And there's a lot more water on Earth than there is land, I think.
Yeah, so plenty more space for data centers.
Plenty more space for data centers to be submerged.
It does bring to mind that, like, if in the years to come, if underwater data centers do become more commonplace, that would really change the game in terms of data center tools. You know, combine it with a bit of deep sea diving and stuff like that. I'd be up for that. Like I say, it does make a difference just walking around a sort of grey old box for a data centre in Slough, where they invariably are. So yeah, I'll be up for that if anyone wants to invite me.
Cool, it's a very, very interesting project. Well, Microsoft's data centre mentioned here is located under the sea, as we said. Is it on a map, I wonder?
Probably not. I don't know, because just the nature of, I don't know for definite, I can't answer this with any authority, but just the nature of data centers is you don't really want people knowing where they are. So I don't know if they would say. Yeah. Oh, well, that's what people say. But if you go, I think I've said this before, if you go on Google Maps and you type in data center, you can find data centers all around the country because people leave reviews for them on Google reviews. Yeah, I found this before. Someone was like, oh, this is a great data center when you're working shifts, great takeaways nearby, and a laundrette. Like, you can find stuff like that. People do. Yeah, there's a data center complex in Park Royal where that is one of the key selling points according to the Google reviewers. So they are supposed to be off the map, but they very rarely are.
Well, I'm going to also talk about location maps in my case. Published quite a lot this week, especially by my lazy standards, but it was all a bit heavy, like a 3,500-word feature on supply chain management, so I don't really want to talk about that. So I've decided to talk about a couple of linked interviews which I've not written up, at least not yet, and they're both about location data and digital mapping. So one was with a software developer at Ordnance Survey, guy called John Hoops, young guy, fairly colourful career so far, involving mountaineering and cycling. I mean, not just pedalling around, but a trip leader for cycling tours and things like that. Born in Colorado, kind of grew up in the mountains, mountaineering. Lives in London now. He's an advocate for what Ordnance Survey can do for the broader location data community. Now, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a location data community in the UK, but apparently there is. And the second interview was with the CEO of Esri UK, a guy called Stuart Bonthrone. And he was keen to mainly talk to me about how geographical information systems software can be used to help solve the housing crisis. And as we know, the pandemic has shone a light on that. You know, people without green spaces, cities like London, working from home, but maybe from quite unsuitable accommodation and so on and so forth. So that's mainly what he wanted to talk about. So I'll skip back to Ordnance Survey, just flag a couple of projects that their mapping data is being used for. Now, some of their data is now much more accessible than it was before through a thing called the Data Hub, the Ordnance Survey Data Hub, which is a recent thing. It was launched in July, and it came out of it's a thing called the Geospatial Commission, which is a government thing, sits under the Cabinet Office. And I've written about this a few times before in the past. And the Data Hub is something that's kind of emerged under what the government is trying to do to make location data more valuable in terms of the economy. So that's one of the things that came out of that. The Ordnance Survey isn't, they're not the only people who are involved under the kind of umbrella of the Geospatial Commission. There's also the Land Registry, something that's cropped up in our podcast before, the Hydrographic Office. There's a few, but anyway, Ordnance Survey is one of the main ones. So what this means is, this hub, is you can kind of plug into it. So if you're a company, you can add Ordnance Survey maps, which are super detailed, like unparalleled, to your own GIS, your own web or mobile application. So as John explained it to me, this information was there before, but it's now being made more accessible in terms of cost, but also in the sense that you now need less computing resource and specialist GIS expertise than you would have needed before. And he told me about a range of projects. I just thought I'd flag a couple of them. And we can include links on this in the summary article to these. So one is the National Library of Scotland. And what they've done is they've used OS data, up to the minute detailed OS data, to compare with historic maps that they hold. So of how, you know, places used to look like in the past. So for example, you could compare, I'm kind of making this up, I mean, you could compare where our office is based, kind of Broadgate next to Liverpool Street Station, with, say, London before the Great Fire of London or the Great Plague in the mid-1660s, which academics would have a kind of enjoy themselves with that, you know, geographers and so on. So that's kind of an example that I sort of thought of. But back at the National Library of Scotland, one of the key benefits is this, is it saves them time because they don't have to be kind of trying to kind of manage all this massive data themselves. They just get a cut of what they need and they get it when they need it and things like that. And it is really cool to see the two maps side by side. And the National Library of Scotland has loads of maps of the UK from all sorts of periods. But to see those side by side with an up to the minute map from today, it's quite a cool thing. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, I suppose if you could compare, I mean, I might have got this completely wrong, but if you can compare things like green space and how much that's diminished over time, if you can compare, you know, like two bits of maps and see how much has been replaced by housing, or like sometimes you can look at pictures of a high street 100 years ago compared to now and how different it is. And that's quite, you know, interesting, especially like if you've got picture evidence as well.
Yeah, I'd say check it out, because there's nothing like kind of actually seeing these things and kind of comparing I suppose the fascination would be maybe to compare somewhere that you know really well, like where you live or you grew up, and comparing it with how it was in the 1760s or 1880s or whatever. But they weren't really able to do this until, you know, this came along, is my understanding. At least the data wasn't as accessible as now it is. There's another example that you gave, which also I think is quite cool, and I'm not sure how this works in detail, but it's the London Solar Opportunity Map, which is a kind of joint venture between the Greater London Authority and UCL. And it basically, at the end of the day, generates visualizations of where solar panels could go for the best economic and social benefit. I mean, right down to each building, which is, you know, part of Sadiq Khan's plan. It's about making London more sustainable, et cetera, et cetera. But again, I mean, I think that's quite a cool example of using tech for good. One of the things that I like about actually both these interviews is, because quite often in the podcast, technology is almost like a villain because it's involved with surveillance, or, you know, we talked when Bill and Seb came in and talked about their Facebook stories, or when we talked about the algorithms that messed up the Scottish hires and the A-level results and, you know, things like that. But this I think seems to me to be quite a kind of interesting use of data that wouldn't really have been possible a few years back. So it's kind of cool. We're clearly in the very early days of maybe local authorities or startups, universities making use of this kind of data. It's just been going for a few months now. But we'll see where it goes. And as I said, the second interview that I wanted to link in was with Stuart from Esri. Esri's been around for quite some time now. I don't know them that well, but they were founded in America as the Environmental Systems Research Institute in 1969, founded by a guy called Jack Dangermond. And it just strikes me as being quite similar to SAS. I don't know if I've spoken about SAS on the podcast before, but again, a company founded by an academic, Jim Goodnight, in the case of SAS, in a kind of small place. So in the case of Esri, it's Redlands in California. In the case of SAS, it's Cary in North Carolina. And these have become like company towns where most of the people who live in the town work for Esri or work for SAS. And they have this philosophy of really looking after their employees from, you know, they join in their early 20s and they leave when they're like, they retire, basically. And so I find that kind of model of company quite an interesting one. I've not been to visit Esri ever, but I have been to Cary in North Carolina. It's an interesting place to go. Esri's a bit different the way it's organized. So each national company basically is an independent distributor. So Esri UK is a separate thing, and Stuart has ownership as well as being the kind of chief executive of that. They're very prominent in this field of geographical information system software. So for example, you know those John Hopkins COVID dashboards? So Esri is, you know, the software behind those. They also work with Ordnance Survey, again, in the UK, who supplies some of their data. And Esri, in return, supplies Esri software to work with the Ordnance Survey geographical data database. But Stuart, as I said, he was wanting to talk about the housing crisis and how their software can help speed up housing developments. So their customers in this particular market include housing associations and the likes of Knight Frank. They're like a mega estate agency. And their software will enable you to, say, like if you're a local authority and you're looking at a housing development project, you can map the local infrastructure, identify the right projects for local needs, getting the most out of the space that you have. So the point that he was making is that there is no point in building a load of houses if it's in an area, you know, you don't take account of wildlife needs or flood risk or what amenities are available, et cetera, et cetera. And at least according to him, like the whole property development business is ripe for digital transformation. It's done in a very old-fashioned, you know, bit of technology in there, but a lot of pen on paper stuff and people just knowing about areas because they've been surveyors for years and years and years. So one example he gave that they gave is the way that their technology identified, I've got this number written down, 13.5 million square feet of unused space in the city of Westminster, so in one particular London borough. And that's some Knight Frank research that was done using their software. But I'm not a big mapping enthusiast as such, but nevertheless, I did find these two conversations quite eye-opening. As we discussed at the top of the podcast, we're not really going to need maps for this year's conference season. We're just going to be sitting in front of our computers.
Mm-hmm.
But it is Friday, and so in a sense, mapping out next week. I've got some Oracle Open World beginning next week. Caroline, are you?
Not my conference season doesn't start just yet, but I have seen a sort of ramp up in the amount of just news announcements coming out from various companies. Lots of embargoed news on the cloud side of things for next week, which I can't really talk about now because even by the time the podcast comes out, a lot of it hasn't actually broken yet. So there's definitely a marked ramp up. You know, we've been talking for a few weeks now, like, oh, it's September, things are going to go mad, and things haven't. It's been kind of the calm before the storm. So I think it's all starting to, Q4 is starting to kick off. Or Q4 kind of news cycle is starting to kick off a bit in earnest now.
And Claire, you've got your hands full with our own events.
Yeah, that's going to be my focus for the next couple of weeks before I start thinking about other people's events that I can attend in October onwards.
Splunk is one you tend to go to.
Yeah, that's at the end of October, virtual this year. I'm excited about that. I like it.
Yeah, you do like it. I've forgotten the name of the thing, Buttercup.
Yeah, the horse. Yeah, I wonder how Buttercup's going to feature this year, virtually.
Maybe they'll put them in a Zoom chat, like in a window just on its own, like when they're doing the presentations or something, so you guys don't miss out. Because we talked about that before on the Morning Computer Weekly chat about the service that lets you hire out a goat who can just sit in and dial into your calls. So maybe they'll do the same fate awaits Buttercup.
Yes, that would be brilliant.
Yeah, we've yet to do that. I remember those goats. They were being pimped out. Well, as usual, we'll provide links to all the stuff we've talked about today and the summary article for the podcast and to other stuff too that's relevant. And you can read that on computerweekly.com. But you can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. It just remains for me, as ever, to say thank you to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you to Claire.
Anytime.
And thanks very much to you, listener, for listening. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.